so much.
That looks good.
I'd like to get started, please, if we could. Now, yesterday, I was reminded of the fact that I was talking about plagiarism and the fact that Leibniz and Newton accused one another of plagiarism, even though neither of them plagiarized anybody. And of course, we also went through the plagiarism of Daniel Bernoulli by his father, Johann. And I was reminded of the most famous case of plagiarism in mathematics, and that is about geometry. Because in geometry, of course, plane geometry, two-dimensional geometry, was done by the Greeks over 2,000 years ago. Mr. Euclid, who I remember as being one of the most exciting things I ever learned at school. But three-dimensional geometry, the geometry of a sphere, waited for Riemann in the 19th century. And this is so-called positive geometry, in which the three angles of a triangle add up to more than 180 degrees. And then there was negative geometry, where they add up to less than 180 degrees, rather like saddle geometry. And that was really invented probably by a Hungarian named Bolyai. It was also invented by a Russian named Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. And anybody, and there may be one or two people here old enough to remember the American mathematician Tom Lehrer, who was a maths professor at Harvard and a man with a marvelous sense of humor and a considerable ability to play the piano. And Lehrer wrote a little ditty about Lobachevsky, and I was reminded of this by the very kind gentleman here yesterday, and I just couldn't resist playing it for you. There's not much to see, but there's a lot to hear.
That others all call. Who's the professor that made me that way? The greatest that ever got chalk on his toe. One man deserves the credit, one man deserves the blame, and Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky is his name. Nikolai Ivanovich Lobachevsky. I'll never forget the day I first meet the great Lobachevsky. In one word, he told me the secret of success in mathematics. Plagiarize. Alexandros has friended Petropavlovsk, whose friends somehow is solving now the problem. somewhere else. Index, I copy from all of our stock telephone directories. Local, sensational. Pravda. Well, Pravda says you will come out here, that you know how you like things. But Izvestia. Izvestia said, yeah, you put us on Sarig of Peshkom. It stinks. Petro Goldman Moskva buys the movie rights for 6 million rubles. Changing title to The Eternal Triangle, with Ingrid Bergman playing part of the Hypotenuse.
I apologize in some sense, but I couldn't resist. I don't know how many of you speak Russian, but the Russian is real. Not all of it did I understand. Боже мой, I got. It's my God. Anyway, we'll go back to the real thing. Lehrer, of course, is all over YouTube for those of you too young to remember him, but he enlivened my years as a graduate student. Anyway, back to Isaac Newton. Newton, by this time roughly 1715, 1720, was a very famous man, of course, and he was the president of the Royal Society, he was the master of the mint. He spent a lot of time at court. And of course, as I mentioned, Princess Caroline, the Princess of Wales, was very interested in his in philosophy and in his work. So they spent a lot of time conversing. And she asked him in particular about the education of her children, one of whom, of course, then went on to become George III. And I don't know whether his madness represented Newton's education technique or not. But if you've seen the Alan Bennett play, then he had other things wrong with him. Anyway, but one, in conversation, Newton admitted that he had written a chronology of ancient events. And she said, oh, I would love to have a copy. And that's a royal command, and royal commands must be obeyed. So he gave her one. Now, chronology of ancient events. Newton tried to do this on a scientific basis. So let me mention a little bit about how this is done. Everybody knows, at least we've known for the last several hundred years, that the Earth rotates about its axis. And this is the diurnal daily rotation. Also, we all now know that the Earth rotates around the Sun in 365 and a quarter, roughly, days. And that's fine. But in the Northern Hemisphere, the axis of the Earth points to one particular star called Polaris, the North Star. And if you look at the stars at night, they all revolve. That star stays the same, of course, as the Earth is turning. However, that has not always been true, because the axis of the Earth also revolves. It makes a circle. It's tilted at 22 and a half degrees with respect to the plane in which the planets rotate, and it makes a circle. This circular motion is called precession, and it is due to the fact that first, the Earth is not a perfect sphere. Remember I said the Earth was an oblate sphere. That is, the equator, the equatorial diameter is bigger than the polar diameter because of its spinning motion. There are tidal forces on the Earth due to the Sun and the Moon affecting the Earth's motion. And so this makes this gradual precession. It takes about 26,000 years to go around one time in a circle. Now, for centuries, I mean millennia, in fact, people have been watching the solstice, which is, of course, that the sun progresses to the north and then stops and then moves to the south. And the solstice is the time when the sun stops moving either to the north or to the south and starts in the other direction. And they've noticed where this solstice occurs in the evening, in the night sky. And Newton, and people have written this down, and so you can use the information about the position of the stars more or less to date events. And Newton has done this. And he wrote a chronicle, which he, of course, he gave to Princess Caroline, but he also gave to this man I mentioned yesterday, this Venetian nobleman who came originally to support Leibniz, the Abbe Antonio Scinella Conti, and Conti plays a big role today. And Newton also gave a copy to Conti, but he asked Conti, as usual with Newton, to keep it secret. Conti, and it's called the following, it's called a, he doesn't write short titles, this man, a short chronicle from the first memory of things in Europe to the conquest of Persia by Alexander the Great. The times are set down in years before Christ. Now, Abate did no such thing, that is, keep it secret, and he showed it to all lots of people he knew on the continent, in France in particular. One of them was a Jesuit priest named Etienne Soucier, who was supposed to be the great expert at that time on chronological events of the past. Now, Soucier, of course, was not only Catholic, and Newton didn't like Catholics, but he was a Jesuit, and Newton hated Jesuits. So, and he had had big arguments over mathematics with Jesuits 30, 40 years ago. And so, when people like Soucier and others started to see this, these things, and Newton, as usual, you know, would write the results of his calculations, but nothing about what he did. So people would write letters saying, well, how did you get this? Newton, of course, got angry and refused to answer anybody. But Soucier then went to this Scot John Kyle that I mentioned yesterday as the bear under the saddle of Leibniz. And Kyle then asked Newton. Newton answered a little bit. And I want to read you Kyle's answer. According to his best remembrance, Sir Isaac found that the ancients had recorded that at the time of the Argonauts, Chiron had found the equinoctial points to be in the middle or 15th degree of the constellation Aries. In Meto's time, it was found in the 8th, and in Hipparchus's in the 4th degree of that constellation. Now, Meto was a Greek astronomer of the 5th century BC, Hipparchus of the 2nd century BC. But Jason and the Argonauts is a mythological story, very ancient, so ancient, I mean, it has all these people in it, like Hercules and Prometheus and so forth, and it's so ancient that even Homer knew about it, and Homer, if he really was one person, although I'm told that that's debatable, lived sometime between 850 and 1100 BC, and he already knew about this story, so it's really quite ancient. And so that's mythology, but Chiron, who made this measurement, is a centaur. Anyway, by 1724, Conti was passing this story around all over, quite freely in France, and finally, a Frenchman named Nicolas Fréré published it in Paris. Now, even in Newton's day, when people did not believe in patents and copyrights and things like that, publishing someone else's manuscript, pirating it like that, was considered a bad thing to do. Newton was livid. And when he found out that this was due to the Abbe Conti, he accused Conti of being yet another Venetian Iago and loose from his throne as principal of the head of the Royal Society, these various Jovian thunderbolts. Conti, who was a nobleman, a Venetian nobleman, would not take this kind of rubbish from a low-born man like Sir Isaac Newton, and he wrote this, namely, I don't give any greater esteem to science than quadriller hunting, and it will perhaps be held one day as an object of contempt. So much with this flippant denigration of science, so much for science's greatest intellect. But this whole business started a new war between the French Cartesians and the English Newtonians, and it carried on really for about a century. However, the main contender, Sir Isaac Newton, died just after it begun in 1727, and he was gloriously buried, as I will mention in a bit, in London. And even in Paris, there was a very significant, serious eulogy held for him. Conti, however, could not let go of this, and did lots of scurrilous things. But one of the things he did that I found particularly interesting is he found an alternative system of looking at the world by an Italian who lived in, who was a Neapolitan named Giambattista Vico. And Vico wrote a book called The New Sciences, Nuova Scienza. This is a remarkable work. And it's a work which is completely antithetical to Newtonian physics. But it is the first person ever to write who took mythology seriously as a means of investigating a past human society. And in many ways, he is considered the first person to, if you will, invent anthropology and sociology. He was completely ignored in his lifetime, and then kind of picked up again by the historian Jules Michelet in the early 19th century, and by Auguste Comte, the more or less real father of sociology, and then forgotten again, and more pretty much until 1976, when one of my great heroes, Isaiah Berlin, wrote this book called Vico and Herder, a brilliant book. Not so easy. I've been reading it for several months. I read it years ago, but I've been reading it again. I'm on page 66 after 7 months. It's not the easiest book in the world. Now, Newton's chronology was finally published in 1728, a year after he died. And it was published as the Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended. It consists of about 200,000 words, which is outdone by a large amount by his writings on theology, which come to more than 1 million words, all handwritten with a quill pen, of course. And by way of contrast, the entire Principia, the greatest scientific book probably ever written, is only 172,000 words. It gives you some idea of where Newton's emphasis really lay in his life. For Newton, theology was not separate from his science. To him, theology was another way of understanding God's universe, just as the Principia was. The Bible and the Principia both addressed God's moral and physical aspects of the universe. Everything Newton did was for the greater glory of his God. He did not leave his theological writings until late in his life, when his scientific creativity may have been fading, but in fact wrote on theology throughout his entire career. His history, as he said, sacred and profane, are part of one divine order, and the world physical and the world historical are not essentially different in nature. Everything was a way of investigating God's plan for the universe. For example, what Moses wrote in the Bible was a popularization of the truth. For Newton, the Bible is actual fact, it's not allegory. Okay? What Moses wrote, as I said, is a popularization of the truth. It's truth for the masses, if you will, because Moses had to write in a way that people of his age could understand. Moses knew every bit as much as Newton the Copernican theory of the universe, which of course isn't right, but Newton thought it was. And he understood that, but he couldn't write it at his time, 1200 or whatever it is BC, because people wouldn't get it. So he had to write it in ways that people could understand. To quote Frank Manuel, the man who wrote the psychological interpretation, Moses was a simplifier, not a falsifier, out of a necessity to improve communication. Newton, in his own words, wrote, to describe them distinctly as they were themselves would have made the narration tedious and confusing, amuse the vulgar, he loves that word, and become a philosopher more than a prophet. Now, Newton felt it necessary to reconcile prophecies from the Old and the New Testament, and to he worked hard to minimize the break from Jewish tradition to Christian tradition, so much so that he emphasized things like Jewish officers of synagogues moved quickly over to become bishops of the early church. Also, Newton was deeply interested in prophecy, but for him, prophecy could only be shown in retrospect. So he loved to read things like the Book of Daniel and to go back and show how the Book of Daniel then prophesied or showed how things in the past actually would work. What he refused to do was to use prophecy for the future, and he would never be drawn on questions like when the second coming of Christ would be. Besides, Christ was a human being to Newton and not divine. The Bible revealed not only prophecies, but moral laws, and bore witness to a steady communication between God and man. This is very important for Newton, and his conception of philosophy was not very different from the Jewish philosopher Maimonides. Newton is always seeking to demystify and to talk rationally about the Bible and prophecy. Over and over, he refers to what he calls the fraudulent Catholic religion. And his real nemesis is St. Jerome, the man, of course, who translated the Bible into Latin. He hated Jerome, and he claimed Jerome falsified the Bible in order to emphasize the Trinity, which had been decided as dogma at this Council of Nicaea that I mentioned. Newton, of course, as an Arian, did not believe in the Trinity. And he read amazingly in sources. There's just a quote about which I read for you. But this is a list of the names of people that Newton read. Now, I'm embarrassed to tell you how many of them I recognized, but it wasn't, or I knew about. It's not very many. And I've spent a lot of time in the British Library, where you can pick up the 1910 edition of the famous edition of the Britannica, and has everything in it that ever happened in the world before 1910. And found out a fair amount about these guys. He's just astonishing. He knew all the works, as it says there, of Augustine, Athanasius, and Origen. Athanasius is now Saint Athanasius, and was the man at the Nicaea in 325 who opposed Arius. And he is Athanasius is Newton's particular hate. Also, Newton read a polyglot Bible, which had been published in 1657 by the Bishop of Chester, one Brian Walter. This has texts in it, and Newton could read in the original, in many of these languages, Hebrew, Greek, Syriac, Ethiopian, translated into Latin, Chaldee, Samaritan, Arabic, Persian, etc. And in everything, Jerome is his arch villain. But for Newton, both the Bible and the Principia are equally means of investigating God's plan for the universe. But for him, only texts written by the apostles themselves, only primitive Christianity, is valid. Anything else is just incorrect. He wrote, "The fundamentals of Christian religion are those and only those things which the primitive Christians were taught in catechizing and instructing in order to baptize. And those were to forsake the devil, the lusts of the flesh, the lusts of the eye, and the pride of life, to believe in one God and one Lord and in the Holy Ghost." Now, he was particularly good at abjuring the lusts of the eye and the lusts of the flesh, but not particularly good about getting rid of the pride of life. He even went so far as making models of Solomon's temple as a plan for what heaven would look like. He wrote other books on this in his Million Words on Theology, and published in 1754 was a book with the title The Language of the Prophets, Observations upon the Prophets, an Historical Account of Two Notable Corruptions of Scripture, Paradoxical Questions Concerning the Morals and Actions of Athanasius. Now, this is not so unusual in 17th century Britain. Robert Merton, whom I've mentioned as the author of this wonderful book on the shoulders of giants, has also written several wonderful books on the sociology of science. Science, Technology, and Society in 17th Century England is one of them. And he mentions that the correlation of profound interest in both religion and science, which perhaps would have been incongruous in later times, was a thoroughly consistent aspect of the pervasive Protestant ethic. And for persons imbued with such attitudes, the pursuit of science takes on the cast of a self-evident value. From this, it need not be inferred that the Royal Society could have arisen only if these religious activities were present, but on the other hand, it seems clear that such positive attitudes did much to encourage the development. And so there's a big mix at this time of science and religion. Now, in the midst of all this controversy, on the 20th of March, 1727, Isaac Newton died between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. He left a substantial estate, mostly stocks and annuities in either the Bank of England or the South Sea Company, and he left behind him 8 half-nieces and half-nephews who argued rather bitterly over his estate, and especially over the money. But Newton had befriended one woman in his life, and that was his half-niece, Catherine Barton. And she lived in his house, and was, when he became a famous man and had social events and things, she was the hostess. And she eventually married John Conduit. And the Conduits, John and Catherine, were a very important family, and they grabbed his papers in particular. Now, their daughter, Catherine Conduit, just like her mother, married a man named John Wallop, who was the Viscount Lymington, and they had a son who became the second the second Earl of Portsmouth. And it was by that connection that the papers which John Conduit saved passed into the care of the Portsmouth family in London, and from the Portsmouth family to the Cambridge University Library. And thanks to them, we have these papers still in existence. Now, yesterday we talked about the struggles over priority of the discovery of the calculus between Leibniz and Newton. And again, Merton has written extensively on these problems of simultaneous discovery. And it's very common, simultaneous discovery, as if, you know, in a sense, many scientific discoveries are in the air, and, you know, people are thinking about them and somebody comes up with them first. But violent disputes have arisen between some very mild-mannered people. They don't have to be quite as egocentric as Newton and Leibniz were. But again, as we saw yesterday, it's very often the lieutenants in these fights who are more important than it is the principals, as if they were, you know, my genius is better than your genius sort of argument. Merton explains recognition, and this is, as somebody who did experimental physics for 40 years, I recognize some of this. Recognition for originality becomes socially validated testimony that one has lived up to the most exacting requirements of one's role as a scientist. The self-image of the individual scientist will depend greatly on the appraisals by his scientific peers of the extent to which he has lived up to this exacting and critically important aspect of his role. And it is often this kind of pressure that has led, in addition to not only great discoveries, but also to some of the scientific frauds that have been not so uncommon in the past 50 years or so. What I've also been reading about is the recognition of this remarkable coalescence of religion and science that Newton represented. Even in Newton's day, people were wondering about the utility of science. Why bother to do this stuff? Now, today we wonder about why governments should fund science. But let me read you some of the reasons that were given about the utility of science in Newton's day. there is the religious utility of exhibiting the wisdom of the divine handiwork. There is the economic and technological utility of enabling mines to be workable at increasing depths. There is the economic and technological utility of helping mariners to sail safely to ever more far-off places in quest of adventure and trade. There is the military utility of providing for ever more efficient and inexpensive ways of killing the enemy. There is the plus ça change, is the French saying. The self-development utility of providing a form of mental discipline. We hear this about the study of Latin and even of mathematics today. And finally, the nationalistic utility of enlarging and deepening the collective self-esteem of Englishmen as they advance their claims to the priority of discovery of invention. Now, nationalistic science has not changed. As one who comes from the Sputnik generation, I can tell you that the United States of America changed dramatically in 1957 with the launch of that satellite by the Soviet Union, and every one of my high school friends wanted to study either physics or engineering or mathematics. Most of them went on to become physicians and make lots of money, but the few silly ones of us actually continued into science. And we still see this today in competition with China, for example. And anyway, so that not only was there the coupling of philosophy and religion in Newton's day, but today, of course, we have significant material advantage to be gained as well. There's a lot of money to making inventions. Now, the insistence upon originality for scientists is a driving force for many people in my field, or what used to be my field. The absolute insistence on originality, the absolute nature of space and time, the absolute truth, the pursuit of absolute truth in politics, in social order, in theology, or in any other field of endeavor, of human endeavor, seems to contain the seeds of its own destruction. The case of Newton's view of science is supremely deterministic. Every cause is followed by one unique, specific effect. Newton believed so strongly in this as evidence for the existence of his God that he introduced the concept of absolute space and time. And I want to take a few minutes to talk a little bit about this. Newton's first law, the law of inertia, says that any body will continue to move in a straight line at constant speed unless a force acts upon it to change it. And then his second law says that if a force does act upon a body, then there will be an acceleration. So in order to find a system in which, a situation in which the first law holds valid, we need to find something that is not subject to a force, or not subject to an acceleration. This immediately rules out the Earth, because the Earth is spinning, and therefore it is accelerated. So Newton's law of inertia, this idea of perfect straight line motion at constant speed, cannot hold on Earth. Now, as long as we consider systems small compared to the size of the Earth, it's a good approximation. Okay? And so if you build a bridge, or a tunnel, or an airplane, or a rocket ship using Newtonian mechanics, it will work. Okay? But if you deal with things that are the size of the Earth or not, it's not true. So we could look to the sun. But the sun also rotates, period, about 11 days, so it's moving. So what do we use? Well, on Earth, people tend to use a system of the so-called fixed stars in heaven, and that's our basic reference frame. But those stars are rotating about the center of the galaxy. Our sun makes a tour about the center of the galaxy about once every 100,000 years, roughly. And so that the so-called fixed stars are not any good either. Where does this end? Well, maybe some other galaxy, but all the galaxies appear to be accelerating away from one another. So where do we find the perfect system for Newton? Newton found the perfect system. He invented the perfect system. He said, I will tie it to the throne of God. And that's where absolute system is at rest. Now, absolute space and absolute time disappeared from physics in 1905 with Einstein's theory of relativity. But moreover, even the independent concepts of space and time disappeared from physics, and we were forced to instead to consider a four-dimensional space-time continuum. Newton's laws are now understood to be an approximation, approximately true, and they get worse and worse as we approach the speed of light. They also get worse and worse as we go to smaller and smaller systems. And once we approach the size of atoms or smaller, then not only are Newton's laws no good, but even this deterministic nature that effect always follows cause uniquely is no longer true at all. And although effect follows cause, there are multiple effects that are possible, each one occurring with a given probability, an indeterministic picture. Late in his life, however, Newton appeared to regain some of the naivete of his youth, and he wrote to John Conduit, and again, I'm not sure people in the back could read, but this is a very famous quote of his. I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself and now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all discovered before me, undiscovered before me. At his funeral, the pallbearers were the Lord Chancellor, the Dukes of Montrose and Roxburgh, the Earls of Pembroke, Sussex, and Macclesfield. The service, of course, was held in Westminster Abbey, despite the fact that Newton was true to his Unitarian beliefs and refused the sacraments of the church on his deathbed. A monument, described as a Baroque monstrosity, was erected in 1731. Here is a picture, more or less, of it, and it has Newton reclining here. There are cherubs holding various discoveries. There's a globe, and on top of the globe is a female figure of astronomy, the queen of the sciences. Now, I want to do something that's a little out of character for me, and so I'm a bit nervous, but I'll do it anyway. I discovered a book a number of years ago, which I then put yesterday on the blog, on the website for the course for summer school, by a man named Douglas Bush, who was a professor of English at Harvard, and he wrote a series of lectures, which he then published back in 1950, and they are called, it's called Science and English Poetry, a Historical Perspective from 1590 to 1950. And so there's lots of things, and I've cribbed all sorts of stuff from him, talk about plagiarism. And so for the rest of the time, we're going to talk largely about poetry. And here is a eulogy, parts of a eulogy, written by James Thomson, a Scottish poet. Shall this great soul of Newton quit this earth to mingle with his stars, and every muse astonished in this silence shun the weight of honors due to his illustrious name? And but a few of the deep studying race can stretch their minds to what he knew, an amazing thing, an appreciation of what a brilliant man he was. And it's not just this eulogy where poets are affected, because in the 18th century, Newton was the great revealer of divine wisdom and power. He saw everywhere in the universe proofs, not only of the design, both minute and majestic, but of God's continuously active care of the universe. God, for him, is an eternal, infinite, omniscient spiritual being who is imminent in all creation, especially that of man. His entire physics can and will become a support for deism, which is this theology in which there's a belief in the existence of a creator, but not of a revealed religion. And deism, which is so strong in the 18th century, played a very strong influence on the founding fathers of the American Republic, despite what Sarah Palin might think. John Locke, the great friend of Isaac Newton and the greatest 17th century representative of rationalism, was the heir of people like Descartes and Hobbes, and if you like, the father of such unusual and diverse children as Bishop Berkeley and David Hume. I'll skip a few things here. I wondered, because I've been so impressed by Newton's influence in the 18th century, and I found this magnificent book by Ernst Cassirer, a great philosopher of his own in his own right, called Kant's Life and Thought. And it's fantastic because it helps me to understand the Critique of Pure Reason, which is a book I've been trying to understand most of my life, and it's hard. And he made me feel much better because he said Kant went out of his way to make it difficult. Probably with me in mind, I don't know. He writes here because Kant's first paper, written about 25 years after Newton died, was on what is called, in English, Thoughts on the True Estimation of Living Forces. Now, living forces in that era meant what we call today kinetic energy. Lebenskraft in German, I think. But in particular, he sides with Newton against Descartes because he says, Newtonian mechanics, and I mentioned this yesterday, which is why I'm reading it again, totally rejects any conclusion as to the essence of force and sees the description and calculation of phenomena as the sole task of imperial science. And this was asserted throughout the 18th century ever more strongly and uncompromisingly. And it is what has led to the removal of metaphysics from science and has made a huge effect. Locke quoted Newton as saying that the scientific philosopher can hold that the moral law is as capable of demonstration as mathematics. Thomas Spratt, a clerical historian of the Royal Society, thought that science could explain the soul through mathematics. It's not unlike the discussion that has taken place over the last 20 or 30 years about the mind-body dualism, by the way. But no poet is more famous in our time as being influenced by deism, I think, than Alexander Pope, born 1 year after the publication of the Principia in 1688. Now, he is the person who I started with his epigram to Newton. But this has been modified in the 20th century in the following fashion. So God said, let Newton be, and all was light. It could not last the devil shouting ho. Let Einstein be, restored the status quo. But Pope, in particular, exemplifies a lot of the deistic spirit of the age. In probably one of his most famous works, perhaps his most famous work, The Essay on Man, there is a shining picture of this mechanistic universe. And he writes of the infinity of divine reason. And the infinity of divine reason whose beneficent purposes must remain hidden from the partial knowledge of man. This is a very important point that I'll come to over and over again, because what do you do about evil in the world for these people? And he writes, and I have some of this on slide, but not all, vast chain of being which from God began, nature's ethereal, human, angel, man, beast, bird, fish, insect, what no eye can see, no glass can reach, from infinite to thee, from thee to nothing. This poem goes on and on and on, and it's all in rhyming couplets. I'm amazed by this man. But this verse in particular just stuns me. all nature is but art unknown to thee, all chance direction which thou cannot see, all discord, harmony not understood, all partial evil, universal good. And spite of pride in erring reason, spite one truth is clear, whatever is right. Well, I beg to differ, but that's all right. A great deal of what Pope is saying is really of the essence of traditional Christianity, but at least according to, and I think he's right, Professor Bush, the way in which he deals with this is very different from, say, John Donne or John Milton. And in particular, the removal of evil, or the abstraction of evil, is really vastly different from the presence of evil, say, in Paradise Lost. This growth of rationalism, which invariably brought up the question of whether Christianity itself was reasonable. And what had been reasonable for the earlier people, like Milton and like the Cambridge Platonists who had helped educate Newton when he was a student, this no longer seemed reasonable for lots of deists. However, instead of giving up on reason, whatever conflicts there were, they limited themselves to biblical criticism rather than to overthrowing religion at all. There was a confidential basis, a belief in universal reason and in universal order. Science is a sister of religion and of poetry, not an enemy. Natural science explores and reveals the work and ways of God. Poetry makes such revelations vivid and intelligible to mankind at large. Thomson did not only eulogize Newton, but he eulogized other scientists, Bacon, Boyle, Shaftesbury, Locke, and as well as Shakespeare, Milton, Spencer, Chaucer. All are molders of life, all are important. The split between science and religion comes considerably later. Pope's final words here, whatever is right, is the inference that evil in the world must be due to our inability to see God's overall plan for the universe. This is a belief which Voltaire made fun of or satirized based on Leibniz's concept, in Voltaire's word, of the best of all possible worlds, which he put into the mouth of Dr. Pangloss, his figure of Leibniz in his Candide. Pope also wrote, this is, "Thou great first cause least understood, who all my sense confined, to know but this, that thou art good, and that myself are blind. To thee whose temple is all space, whose altar earth, sea, skies, one chorus let all being raise, all nature's incense rise." This comes from a poem called Universal Prayer. So, I mean, and Pope is not the only one. Here is something from Joseph Addison, most famous in my English courses as the editor of the Spectator. I hope you can read. "The spacious firmament on high, with all the blue ethereal sky and spangled heavens a shining frame, their great original God proclaim. The unwearied sun from day to day does his creator's power display and publishes to every land the work of an almighty hand." The recognition that the universe is the work of an almighty hand has been part of many philosophies and probably all religions for all time, and certainly an integral part of Christianity, but not the most important part in Christianity. But it constitutes the dominant strain in deistic poetry. Thomson, again, "Who knows how raised to higher life from stage to stage the vital scale ascends?" Or, "This infancy of being cannot prove the final issue of the works of God. By boundless love and perfect wisdom form and ever rising with a rising wind." Thomson, of course, writes in blank verse as opposed to the couplets of Pope. And he's writing almost as if he's speaking of a sense of evolution, from seeming evil still educing good, and better thence again, and better still in infinite progression. Or life rising still on life in higher tone perfection forms, and with perfection bliss. Thompson insists much more than Pope that the Creator is not an absentee God who merely started the world running. God's unremitting energy, as he calls it, and beneficence pervade the complex scheme of things. He stirs each atom. He launched the unwieldy planets along the illimitable void, and should he hide his face, the sun and stars would reel and chaos come again. For Pope, the best of all possible worlds, perhaps, is a dialectical necessity. For Thompson, it's a spontaneous truth. Other poets of this genre are people like Edward Young and Mark Akenside. Young is particularly strong, saying things like, nature delights in progress, in advance from worse to better, or the course of nature is the art of God. He even sees the fact that comets come around as an analogy to the second coming of Christ. And his poems are actually, again, according to Professor Bush, who knows a lot more about this than I do, were said to influence the young Tennyson quite heavily. But in general, poets are looking at the divine beauty of nature as enhanced, not lessened, by scientific explanation of its mysteries. This is amazingly different from people like Blake and the Romantics, who come less than a century later. Thompson and Akenside laud the delight in finding out that the law of refraction gives rise to the rainbow. And this concept of advance from better to worse is a sort of a crude evolutionary theory. Darwin's theory of evolution, of course, makes no claim for any sort of improvement. It's just what happens. Akenside claimed that God created the world in a desire to spread universal good. One of the things that prevented evolution from occurring, even though the poets were writing about it, of course, was people like Bishop Usher and the idea of the interpretation of the Bible. Usher had written in 1650 his claim that the universe was created on the 23rd of October in 4004 BC. And he gets 4004 BC because he goes back and calculates, the so-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he goes back and he counts all those, and he gets 4,000 years, and then he adds 4 years because Christ was born in 4 BC, not in 0. So 4,004. And the last part of the 17th century was replete with books like this, which talked about the age of the world. And this prevented a lot of things. But the last poet I want to mention is the great nature poet William Cowper, who wrote this very famous poem about God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. A lovely poem. Cowper's a wonderful poet, I think. The strongest proponent of evolution in the 18th century was a man named James Burnet, Lord Monboddo. And he wrote that man was, in fact, descended from apes, particularly from the orangutan, by the way. But Bishop Usher was a representative of many people who were interested in the history of the earth and in the history of creation. A very interesting man was a man named Thomas Burnet, no relation to James Burnet, Lord Monboddo. Now, he wrote a book called The Sacred Theory of the Earth, Tellurius Theoria Sacra, back in 1681, and he discussed this book with Newton. And I have a picture of the cover of that book, and I hope you can see that. There's Christ at the top, and underneath Jesus' left foot is the original earth, unformed. and then it becomes the earth of Adam and Eve, perfect in every way, followed by the great flood. And if you're up close and you can see that black mark, that's Noah's Ark. And when the waters recede, we are left with the cracked and crumbly earth that we have today. But according to the prophets, this will be replaced by the sun. The earth will be consumed by fire at some point, and that's here. And then, when the earth has been burnt up, and the ashes and soot come back down, forming concentric perfection again, over in this picture, then Christ and his saints will live there for 1,000 years, following which everybody is then taken up to heaven or sent down to hell, no matter what. I have no doubt about which direction I'm heading. And then the earth is no longer needed, and so finally it turns into a star, which is under the right foot of Christ. It's a remarkable book. There is another wonderful book I'll mention to you, written by Stephen Jay Gould, a very interesting man who's unfortunately died a few years ago, called Time's Arrow, Time's Cycle, to compare the ideas of cyclical time with linear time throughout history. But I want to read two little quotes from Burnett because I find them absolutely remarkable. This is a man in 1681 and a very religious man, as you can see. He says, "'Tis a dangerous thing to engage the authority of Scripture in disputes about the natural world in opposition to reason, lest time, which brings all things to light, should discover that to be evidently false which he had made Scripture to assert." I wish that Urban VIII had read this when he was dealing with Galileo. "We are not to suppose that any truth concerning the natural world can be an enemy to religion, for truth cannot be an enemy to truth. God is not divided against himself." He also wrote that it is an absurdity to think that this little planet where we sojourn for a few days is the only habitable part of the universe. 1681. There's a very interesting difference between people like Burnett and Thompson and Pope and Leibniz, who thought that God created the universe and it was the earth and it was perfect and ran forever, and those like Newton and Cowper, who think that God is continually putting his hand in to make things work right. A ceaseless, Cowper calls it a ceaseless force, ceaseless service by a ceaseless force. For all of these poets, there's the problem of reconciling their universal hymn to God and harmony with all the disasters and ills of the real world. They don't seem to be embarrassed by these contradictions at all, or find them particularly awkward. Their answer is always that we poor humans have only very limited vision, and what to us seems vain or evil in the world is really a part of the total good. Again, some sort of Leibnizian best of all possible worlds. The deists, of course, were not the only representatives during this time. There were people opposing them, the rationalists, traditional Christian humanists, in particular Jonathan Swift and Dr. Johnson, deeply conscious of the potentialities of evil. Swift was very quick to point out the extravagances and pretensions of science. And within a century of Pope's couplet about Newton, William Blake assailed the great evil triumvirate Bacon, Newton, and Locke. I have a quote from Bush, that the triangular harmony of science, religion, and poetry had, like most triangular situations, not proved permanent. Whereas the earlier scientists, thinkers, and poets had occupied a good deal of common ground, the further development of science, of anti-Christian rationalism, and of evangelical Christianity, and of poetry, was dividing a community of relatively homogeneous culture into groups embracing diverse and opposing kinds of knowledge and belief. This impermanence has also led to impertinence, and I have a little jingle to end with that's properly impertinent. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, I don't wonder what you are, for by the spectroscopic ken, I know that you are hydrogen. Our universe is indeed a very strange place. Our innate common sense is of no use in understanding how things really work. Hamlet's statement to Horatio that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy is applicable in every sense to Isaac Newton, even more so to Albert Einstein, and yet more so to Niels Bohr. But this idea that the universe is both rational and difficult to understand is the very essence of scientific investigation, and I, for one, hope that such investigations will continue for a long time. Now, that brings to an end what I have to say about Isaac Newton, but I wanted to mention, as I was asked to, that Isaac Newton, as I stressed over and over, wrote his Optics, his second greatest work, and was a person who wrote a huge amount about how light works. Because he was such a dominant figure, his ideas of optics occupied the 18th century absolutely from beginning to end, despite the fact that many of his ideas are completely incorrect. But his authority was such. Now, At the very beginning of the 19th century, his ideas about the fundamental nature of light were shown to be wrong. And they were shown to be wrong by a man who used to live on a street down which I walked several times a week in London, one Thomas Young. And so I will talk a little bit about Young and his discoveries next Thursday and Friday, and I think it's in your book somewhere. Anyway, thank you very much. I've had a very good time. People want to talk or have questions or whatever. I think this thing is tight sometimes. No light. No, I don't know, maybe I don't hear me. Oh, okay.
Oh, you're right.
I'll get touch with you on that arms thing.
Thank you very much.